Om Ajnanati Madanasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Dhena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
Laguna Beach, September 11th, 2014, Thursday evening program.
Later on, they came back without success. And Prabhupada had mentioned that because in their hearts they had not made the decision that they would absolutely do or die. They had some other motive. So the definition of a decision or to decide, given in the dictionary, is that after receiving information, one makes a positive choice to do something. So this is a very fortunate, and this is the point at which it's fortunate. I say that because to be able to make a decision to surrender to Krishna is fortunate. It means that one has been given some good fortune by previous contact with devotees. Just based on, we're talking about decisions and how powerful they are. And that once one decides within one's heart to do something, then one discovers energies and gets a help that one had never expected. William Murray, who climbed Mount Everest practically before anyone else had, in such a spectacular way with a team of mountaineers, had thought about it during his lifetime and dreamed about it. And he said, not until he made the absolute decision that he would do it, did the energies and the help come into his life. Ralph Waldo Emerson made a similar statement about how once one decides to do something, that the universe conspires to help him or her achieve the end. So life is full of decisions. Every day there are many decisions, especially if you're doing construction work. A construction worker once told me that there are more decisions per hour in doing construction than any other thing. I thought when we were doing a remodel in our house once that we just tell them what to do and they do it. Then I realized I had to be there for 3 months because they'd come to me and be like, this is not available, you want that instead? I said, I don't want that instead. Well, you want us to do something else? And you have to constantly decide. And throughout our lives, there are so many decisions to make. And they're not always clear cut. Have you ever found that? It's not that you just say yes or no, or yes, I'll take this and not that, but oftentimes, in fact, there was a famous movie with Meryl Streep called Sophie's Choice about a woman who had to decide between her son and her daughter being taken away to a concentration camp. How do you do that? It's impossible. I mean, many of the decisions we make are impossible. And so this is a great challenge to us moving through this world. And many of you, I'm sure, have had decisions to make in your life that has been challenging. Yes? Or yes? And so, how to make those decisions in such a way that one makes progress in life. First of all, as I began, the very act of making a decision, being decisive and saying, this is what I'm going to do. When it's related to any worldly endeavor, there's magic, there's power. As Goethe said, as William Murray attested to. And when it's done in devotional service, that is the main motivating factor that I've made the decision, I'm going to do this. Everything else is put aside. Now, it doesn't mean that immediately your external circumstances will change. Because there's a way in which I've got so much momentum in this world and the circumstances that I'm in now mean that I have obligations that I have to uphold. However, once the decision is made within the heart, once I make a decision within the heart, in my own heart, and I say, this I'm going to do, do or die, then Krishna responds. And there are many verses in the Bhagavad Gita in which Krishna talks about how he responds. And one of them we read last night. There's a purport. May I have a Bhagavad Gita, please? I would use this, but if there's a book available, I'd rather promote the book because I'm trying to forestall the advance of e-technology. Chapter 9:30.
Did you want the Bhagavatam as well?
Yeah, sure. Actually, I could read the Bhagavatam part on him. In this Bhagavad Gita, 9th chapter, 30th verse, Krishna says, 29th verse, Krishna says that Samoham sarva bhuteshu nami dvesho stinapriyaha ye puchanti tumam bhaktya mai teshu chapyaham. I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I'm equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him. And in the purport, Prabhupada writes that the Lord of living entities in a pure state are called devotees. The Supreme Lord becomes the devotee of his devotees. If a reciprocal relationship is not present between the devotee and the Lord, then there is no personalist philosophy. In the impersonal philosophy, there is no reciprocation between the Supreme and the living entity. But in the personalist philosophy, there is. And then Prabhupada gives the example of a desire tree. And a desire tree is a tree that gives you whatever you want, which could be dangerous if you want the wrong thing. If you're not clear on what your desire is, if you ask for something that is harmful or is not in your best interest. But here, I want to point out the fact that Krishna reciprocates. And this is the most amazing and wonderful experience for the soul. In fact, it's what everyone's looking for. It's reciprocation. And when on the theme of decisions, once one makes a decision in a relationship, in any relationship, and says, I'm going to devote myself to this person, then there is an obvious change. There's a way that we can actually feel in intangible ways the determination within the heart of a person, the devotion and the decision to dedicate one's life to someone in service. So in the same way, when we make a decision that I'm going to take to devotional service, then Krishna reciprocates. A couple of verses in the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that for those who have this have made this decision, Tesham satata yuktanam pachatam kriti purvakam dadami bhuti yogam tam yenamam ubhiyantike. Those who worship me with love, to them I give intelligence how to come to me. And then he says, Tesham ivanakam partam aham jnana jantamaha nashayam yatma bhavasto jnana dipena pashtata. That he says, just like a shining lamp in their heart, for those who are sincere and trying to approach me and have made that decision, I illuminate their heart just like with a lamp of knowledge. Yes?
I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
On the theme of decisions, I don't want to derail the direction you're going in.
No, it's nice to keep to one point for a while.
So I'll start and okay. You can stop. And my questions are, as a result of hearing from you, they become sort of semi-commentatorial, but they're open-ended, so I'm looking for some feedback.
Okay.
You mentioned that Emerson said, when you make a decision, the universe conspires to make that possible. I started thinking then, you know, there's this idea that any decision you make, weird, independently powerful force in the universe, somehow we're the cynosure of reality. Our decision-making power is, to some extent, absolute. The universe bends to our will. There's this sort of incredible sense of empowerment there. But it also seems to run a little bit contrary to the idea that we are not the center of the universe. There's something greater. You know, the role of life is to come in tandem with that as opposed to enforce our will. So I started to wonder about the difference between prayas, or getting overly attached to something and endeavoring for it, and having that, you know, nischat, or that determination, and how, you know, how to walk the fine line between those two things. That was question A. And then you continued speaking, and you segued out.
Can I deal with one at a time?
Of course you can.
So can you make that into like a one-sentence question?
How to walk the line between being determined and making decisions and being and going low and coming in tandem.
That's such a nice question. Thank you very much. How to maintain this determination and at the same time go with the flow? Well, the determination to surrender to Krishna is important. And this may seem mysterious because we don't exactly know what's going to happen. And in that regard, Prabhupada once said that we have these four regulative principles and there are replacements for them. And the replacement for gambling is surrender to Krishna. Because normally we try to keep everything close and try to control the outcome of everything, but if one decides I'm going to surrender to Krishna, then it's like a gamble. So, as one surrenders to Krishna, one allows for various changes to come in one's life and takes them as Krishna's mercy. Tate anukampam susumikshamano bunjane eva makritam vipakam. There's a way in which the devotee puts himself in the hands of Krishna with this determination. It's a determination that I'm putting myself in the hands of Krishna. It's well-reasoned faith. I've ruled out the fact that I can do it myself. Maybe I've had experience that didn't work out, my plans don't work out so well. And that I see that there's a logic and a force to the scripture which gives me direction. And I accept the fact that there's a personal God that has all power and all benevolence. And then, based on those premises, I make my decision to surrender to Krishna. And as I do, the going with the flow, there's determination in that, but I'll have to go with the flow because I may have to adjust my life in various ways as I go forward. And so what I mean by that is that it's not just a straight line. There's a way in which I'll have one decision after another to make in my life, even in my devotional life, or especially in my devotional life. And the best way to do that is to decide, based on what's best for my increasing my service. This is an infallible way to remain determined and go forward in my devotional life, but at the same time adjust, because I may have to make adjustments. That's what decisions are, in a way. I have to make an adjustment. Which way do you want to go with this? And so, Nirkul and I were just talking about this recently. We've talked about it a lot. It's a principle that we talk about throughout our lives together in devotional service. And last week we were in New York at the Bhakti Center. We were invited by a couple of devotees to to preside over their engagement ceremony, and they asked us to give some advice. So Nirankula had given the advice that whatever decisions you make throughout your life, base them on what's best for your service, and then you'll never lose. You can't lose. And so I'm hoping this is hitting the mark, but it's just that the determination should be to surrender to Krishna. And the going with the flow is that as I make my decisions, I'm willing to adjust my direction according to what's best for my service. For instance, you may have a choice to make. You can make a lot more money in one job, but it's much farther away from the association you need to advance in devotional service. That may be too easy. Right? That's kind of an easy... They're often more nuanced than that and a little more subtle. But you have to look at it really carefully and honestly say, what's the best decision for my service? And that's surrender. Because that's the definition of surrender. One of the aspects is to accept those things that are favorable for devotional service. You want to ask more to refine, to get at what you were actually asking? Or did that help?
That helped, and I'll just make a follow-up statement and perhaps a comment on.
All right.
I noticed that you segued away from a generic statement about determination and decisions, like you might get from a book like The Secret, and you then made decisions about devotional service. You made two different kind of levels of decisions. And then even within that devotional service decision, which might seem also like a really open-ended universe, you began limiting that to the decision to surrender to Krishna. And so you did that before I asked my question, so you were already sort of beginning to help me get a better understanding. But when I asked my question, you reinforced that, because you made the point that the opposite of gambling would be a sure thing, and a sure thing is surrender to Krishna. And how that looks may change and have a number of different details, but that principle remains the same. So when you think of decisions as when I do, I think of detailed decisions, but you're speaking in a much more existential sense about the ultimate decision, the decision of surrendering your life to Krishna. And then those details may vary, they may ebb, they may flow, they may move, but that could be something that remains the same. Had I understood you correctly?
Yeah, and I just, as far as detailed decisions go, when one centers one's life around the principle of advancing in devotional service, which is Rupa Goswami gives this Nama Rupa Charitari Sukirtananu Smrityo Kramena Rasanama Sindhiyoja, that there's a way in which one should organize one's life around the principle of hearing and chanting and doing other devotional activities. And then there may be detailed decisions to make throughout one's day and week and month and so forth. Then one can also base those decisions on what's best for the center of my life, which is my hearing and chanting. And in that way, you will also be successful. Because without that, then the decisions that you make will become relative and inconsequential in the end. But if you stick to this principle of maintaining your hearing and chanting, especially the basics, and then you center your decisions around that, like, I don't know, what time you're going to go to bed? How is that going to affect your ability to steadily hear and chant in the morning, which is very powerful if one is able to sustain a program of the basic hearing and chanting each day, especially repeating Krishna's names in japa session, and also reading, especially from Prabhupada's books, Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, Shirsha Upanishad, and those books in a systematic way every day. And you base your decisions around minute to minute, like, how's this going to affect my hearing and chanting? I'll give you an interesting circumstance. I took a course in the Dallas Temple several years ago called Leadership and Management, given by Anuttama Prabhu. Somebody who had an MBA told me that They had taken both the leadership and management, and they also got an MBA from a top flight university, and he said the leadership and management course was better. So I thought, I better take it. So a bunch of us came from our temple and we took that course, which was really fun anyway, because we were all together taking a course. And we found it really useful and valuable. And what they did was they created an environment, I should say, Anutama created an environment in which we learned so much, we gathered so much information in a systematic way. And on the last day, late in the afternoon, he announced to us that each of the groups, and we were divided into teams, would have to make a presentation the next morning. And he purposely waited till the last minute for us to have to organize ourselves and put together the presentation based on all the information, because he said that's a real life circumstance, and that's what's going to happen to you when you're doing leadership and when you're doing management and so forth. So I was in our group. I had been asked to facilitate the group and be the leader of the group, and so I had to figure out a time when we could convene and decide on the presentation. And so Jayavaita Swami was in my group. And I made a foolhardy suggestion that we could meet the next morning. It was right around the time of Bhagavatam class, because that time we could talk and we could figure it out. And he looked at me with such disgust. And he said, "Oh great, the old ISKCON management skip Bhagavatam program for the sake of management." It was like, he looked at me with such disgust that I would even suggest such a thing, to skip the Bhagavatam class, to manage something. And that was the best lesson I learned in the whole... I mean, I learned so many things, but that was the culmination. It really stuck in my mind, because he had had so many experience over the year. The benefit of all the times he had seen people sacrifice their hearing and chanting for the sake of management. And how that doesn't work ultimately, because there's no foundation. It really impressed me. So we decided at another time, which was wholly inconvenient, but all the time I was thinking, you know, this is based on a principle. And our presentation turned out really well. And the experience was great. And I thought about that a long time afterwards. Your decision to hold your devotional service, it means something. It means something practical, that every day you keep your basics. You always win with the basics in anything. If you're a musician, or you're an athlete, or you're a parent, you have to find out what are the basics, the fundamentals that actually hold everything together. And you have to learn to do them well and refine them and do them every day, very systematically, methodically. And in devotional service, if we have that as our basic decision, that this is how I'm surrendering, based on Rupa Goswami's suggestion that we organize our life around this principle, then the rest of the decisions can be based on that. What time will I do something? How will we arrange things? All the different things, they go around that one basic principle. This is surrender. And it's sweet surrender, because then one has the benefit of making incremental progressive advancement over time as one's doing one's other work. Another part to your question?
My understanding of what you just did was that I tried to essentialize down what you were saying to merely a principle without any details. And you'd already foreshadowed the principle that you should do whatever is favorable for your spiritual life. When I tried to essentialize it down too much, you jumped in and you gave a further piece of advice. It was not even just what's favorable for your spiritual life, but what's favorable for your daily hearing and chanting, your basic sadhana, your ability to read on a daily basis, associate with devotees, do regulated service. And so in addition to this principle, you've also tried to articulate a very simple, universally applicable kind of series of subsequent questions one could ask themselves, so that we're not just left in an enigmatic, open-ended sort of Krishna moment, and then we have to fend for ourselves. You're trying to give us a structure for our sadhana that would be applicable for the rest of our lives. Have I understood it correctly?
Yeah, I think that's... I have this... there's a way in which if... sometimes people come forward and say, oh, please, can I have some blessing? And they say, chant one chapter of Bhagavad Gita a day. I say, what do you want? What is a blessing anyway? Where does it come from? And they're like, do this. There is a blessing in that. You know, you do it. And it comes to, like, there are principles in spiritual life that one may pontificate about or ruminate on. But then when it comes to actually, if you just do it, if you just open the Bhagavad Gita, you get a direct experience. And it's very powerful. And if you organize your life around, you know, these principles, then over time there's unimaginable progress. Yeah. One other point I want to make, I just want to read a few verses from the Bhagavad Gita based on what I'm saying now. And there's a very moving section of the Bhagavad Gita, and it also has relevance to our lives. And it is when Akura goes to Vrindavan, pick up Krishna and bring him back to Mathura. Where I'm reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam 10th canto, and verse is number 4, starting 10th canto, chapter 38. And this is about Akura going to Vrindavan. So a very interesting circumstance. And one reason I like this opening section to the Bhagavatam is it relates somewhat to decision making, because it indicates the complexity of our lives, and that one may decide to do devotional service, but there may be all kinds of circumstances which seem almost contradictory that we have to live through, because that's the way this world is. We're a combination of matter and spirit. We're encased in matter. And that includes subtle matter, and that includes a connection to socially to so many people and circumstances and so on. So you'll get the idea when I read these few verses and make some comments. The first verse, and this is 10:38:1 for those who are keeping score. Shukadeva Goswami said, after passing the night in the city of Mathura, the high-minded Akura mounted his chariot and set off for the cowherd village of Nanda Maharaj. Purport. King Kamsa ordered Akura to go to Vrindavan on the Ekadashi of the dark fortnight of the Vedic month Phalgun. After spending the night in Mathura, Akura left early the next day. That morning, Narada offered his prayers to Krishna in Vrindavan, and in the afternoon, the demon Vyoma was killed there. At dusk, Akura entered the Lord's village. Text 2. As he traveled on the road, the great soul Akura felt tremendous devotion for the lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, and thus he began to consider as follows. Sri Akura thought, what pious deeds have I done? What severe austerities undergone? What charity given to a worthy recipient? So that today I will see Lord Keshava. Since I am a materialistic person, absorbed simply in sense gratification, I think it is as difficult for me to have gotten this opportunity to see Lord Uttamashloka as it would be for one born a Shudra to be allowed to recite the Vedic mantras. Text 5. But enough of such thoughts. After all, even a fallen soul like me can have the chance to behold the infallible Supreme Lord. For one of the conditioned souls being swept along in the river of time may sometimes reach the shore. I'll read that again. But enough of such thoughts. After all, even a fallen soul like me can have the chance to behold the infallible Supreme Lord. For one of the conditioned souls being swept along in the river of time, they sometimes reach the shore. This parallels, and this goes to the attitude of the devotee, that it parallels the opening prayers of Prahlad Maharaj. After Lord Nrsimhadeva appears, the demigods come forward and they all offer prayers. to appease the Lord, and he's not satisfied at all. So Lord Brahma pushes Prahlad Maharaj forward, who's a five-year-old boy, and says, you try. He came for you, you try. So Prabhupada comments in one place that it's like pushing a five-year-old boy into the cage of a lion. So Nrsimhadeva was roaring and angry, and he pushed Prahlad Maharaj forward. And then Prahlad Maharaj began his prayers by saying, the demigods have glorified you in streams of excellent words. They know Sanskrit, and they're the mode of goodness. And they come from high birth, but I'm born in a demoniac family, and I'm just a child, what can I say? And then he said, but I think that even if I have all kinds of excellent worldly qualities, like strength and intelligence and diligence and beauty and so forth, that won't satisfy the Lord completely. And then he remembered Gajendra the elephant. Bhaktya tutosha bhagavan gajayutapaya. Gajendra was the king of the elephants, for those of you who know the story. He had been a king in his previous life, Indrajumna, and he was cursed. So in the next life he became an elephant. But in his previous life he had been devoted to the Lord and he recited beautiful prayers every day. And in his life as an elephant, he lived in a heavenly planet. He was the king of the elephants. He was very happy. He had a nice family. One day he went to the lake to bathe. And there he was enjoying spraying his family members with the cool waters near the Chitrakoot Mountain. Beautiful heavenly planet. And suddenly out of nowhere, he was captured by a crocodile, grabbed onto his leg. And he struggled for years and came to a realization that I can't win. And every one of us will come to that point at some time that I'm helpless. I'm helpless, absolutely helpless. I have to call out. In fact, these opportunities come very rarely to us in this lifetime. I call it teachable moments. A moment when I actually can open myself completely. I saw it with my mother. My father died a year before my mother. They had been married for 70 years. And she was a very upright, intellectually powerful person her whole life, interested in God, Krishna consciousness, topics of the absolute, and so forth, but only intellectually, not with the heart. And I saw after my father left that gradually she realized that she had been grabbed by a crocodile. And that the construct of her life was now not what she thought it had been before. And she was looking for shelter this way and that. And I saw it in her. I was with her. It was a very intimate experience. And 2 years, two months before she left, you know, she gave herself to this idea of like, okay, I'm open, I'm teachable now. It was amazing, and our relationship completely changed. It wasn't I was no longer the son. I became, okay, please teach me something, the teacher. And in Gajendra, you can see how he came to this point where he had no other recourse, and then from his heart, he remembered these prayers from his previous life, and he began to call out to the Lord. Practically, he didn't even know what he was praying, and practically, at that point, he didn't even know who God was. But there was this immense feeling that came out of him because of his previous practice. Even the demigods heard the prayers, and they were listening and said, those aren't for us. So, Bhagavatam says, better one moment of full consciousness in this life than a lifetime which is simply wasted on the mental plane, thinking about the next kind of sense gratification. One moment of full clarity that I'm dependent and I need help and I'm calling out. So Gajendra had that. And then Prahlad Maharaj remembered that state of consciousness when he was thinking, how do I actually present myself before the Supreme Personality of Godhead? What can I possibly say? What can I? I have no qualification. And then he remembered Gajendra. Bhaktya tutosha bhagavan gajayutapai. It means he satisfied the Lord by his bhakti, which is this vulnerable, complete willingness to open himself up in this helpless state and simply offer himself completely to the Lord. Bhaktya Tosha, he satisfied the Lord, the king of the elephants. So when Prahlad remembered that, he said, okay, I can do it too. And then he declared, he made a few other statements about how one may be born as a Brahmin, highly learned, and have all, according to the book, Sanat Sujata, there's a book that tells all the various qualities of the Brahmana, these high qualities by the estimation of this world. But he said, but if that person doesn't have that decision in their heart, the surrender to Krishna, they want something else out of it. He said, that person can't even purify himself. But a person who's born, and he names what, you know, you could, the lowest possible position you can think of is a dog eater. And he's somebody who, they come from that background where that's what they have for Thanksgiving. Dogs. It's not that he accidentally ate a dog, but he actually, so you sit down, let's have some dog. But that's the position that he came from. If that person develops this decision in their heart to surrender to God, then he said he can not only purify himself, but he can purify his whole family. And then Prabhupada in his purport talks about how those who come from any background, even the lowest of backgrounds, if they make this decision in their heart that I'm going to surrender to the Lord, and they understand that it's available, because if one is simply sincere, that Krishna will rally that person from within the heart to go forward fearlessly and make advancement in devotional service, then he can purify people all over the world by that. So these revelations are important to those who are embarking on the process of devotional service, the revelation of Akura. And then it gets more complicated for Akura. Here he's having this revelation that he said, but enough of such thoughts that I'm not qualified. After all, even a fallen soul like me can have the chance to behold the infallible Supreme Lord, for one of the conditioned souls being swept along in the river of time may sometimes reach the shore. And I'm going to come back to this in a second, but I want to read you another verse that reminded me of, that's from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And this verse you'll find in the Madhya Lila, Chaitanya Charitamrita, chapter 19, text number 236. What is chapter 19 in the Madhya Lila? Anybody here know what takes place in that chapter? Run, don't walk, but when you get home, go to your set of Sri Chaitanya Charitamritas and look at chapter 19, because you'll want to read it over and over and over again. And if you run and don't walk and you get home and you don't have a set of Chaitanya Charitamritas, then run to get one on your way out so you can read chapter 19. Because therein is the direct teachings of Lord Chaitanya to Sanatana Goswami, just so moving that, you know, he sits down with this most elevated soul and gives him these very clear instructions, which are also meant for all of us. And they're very practical. It's something that you can read over and over again and you can integrate into your life. But let me read you one verse that's very beautiful that will inspire you and change your life forever. Are you ready? You sure? Okay. Bhavite, bhavite, Krishna Sure Antare. Krishna Kripaya Agna Paya Rasha Shinu Paya. When one thinks of Krishna constantly, love for him manifests within the heart. Even though one may be ignorant, one can reach the far shore of the ocean of transcendental love by Lord Krishna's mercy. Once again, when one thinks of Krishna constantly, love for him manifests within the heart. Even though one may be ignorant, one can reach the far shore of the ocean of transcendental love by Lord Krishna's mercy. So, back to Akura. And he's... now on his chariot. He's left Mathura. And the circumstances are... will be revealed next. Today, all my sinful reactions have been eradicated, and my birth has become worthwhile since I will offer my obeisances to the Supreme Lord's lotus feet, which mystic yogis meditate upon. Indeed, today, King Kamsa has shown me extreme mercy by sending me to see the lotus feet of Lord Hari, who has now appeared in this world, simply by the effulgence of his toenails. Many souls in the past have transcended the insurmountable darkness of material existence and achieved liberation. Here's the purport. It's very short. Akura noted how ironic it was that the envious demoniac Kamsa had given him an extraordinary blessing by sending him to see the Supreme Lord Krishna. And so the circumstances are that Kamsa was thinking constantly how to kill Krishna, because that's what that's his mentality, because he wanted to be the supreme. And he was arranging to send all kinds of hired killers to Vrindavan to try to kill Krishna, including who? Putana. Absolutely. Sent Putana to Vrindavan to kill Krishna when he was just a baby. She was the first one to try. Did she succeed?
Nope.
No, Vaisheshi Kadam. She did not succeed. She was killed in the process by little baby Krishna. Anyone else?
Agasura.
Agasura. Big python demon. Over and over again, Kamsa was sending demons into Vrindavan to kill Krishna. And now he had this plan that he was going to bring Krishna into Mathura, to the big city, out of the little village. And he had an elephant waiting for him. What was the name of the elephant?
Valeria.
Yeah. Big elephant trained just to, you know, spear people with his tusks and so forth. And he was trained to, and he had this plan, he would trample him. And then, if that didn't work out, he had these two big-time wrestlers, Mushtika and Shanura, who were going to wrestle with Krishna, and, you know, they would squeeze the life out of him. And so forth. So he sends Akura to go pick up Krishna and Balaram, and he tells him, this is what we're going to do. I want to kill him. So Akura is a pure devotee. So what kind of situation is this? Being asked, go get Krishna so I can kill him and bring him back. And Akura is on the chariot going into Vrindavan. And so that's the circumstance. I'm going to read a couple more verses because it's going to reveal what Akura is thinking about his duty that he's performing here. Those lotus feet are worshipped by Brahma, Shiva, and all the other demigods, by the goddess of fortune, and also by the great sages and Vaishnavas. Upon those lotus feet, the Lord walks about the forest while herding the cows with his companions, and those feet are smeared with the kumkum from the gopis' breasts. Surely I shall see the face of Lord Mukunda, since the deer are now walking past me on my right. That face, framed by his curly hair, is beautified by his attractive cheeks and nose, his smiling glances, and his reddish lotus eyes. I'm going to see the Supreme Lord Vishnu, the reservoir of all beauty, who by his own sweet will has now assumed a human-like form to relieve the earth of her burden. Thus there is no denying that my eyes will achieve the perfection of their existence. He is the witness of material cause and effect, yet he is always free from false identification with them. By his internal potency, he dispels the darkness of separation and confusion. The individual souls in this world who are manifested here, when he glances upon his material creative energy, indirectly perceive him in the activities of their life airs, senses, and intelligence. I'm jumping ahead a little bit because there's a particular verse I want to read you. And the verses I'm skipping, he's giving more details about how he will see Krishna. Krishna will place his hand on his head and so forth. Then this verse. The infallible Lord will not consider me an enemy, even though Kamsa has sent me here as his messenger. After all, the omniscient Lord is the actual knower of the field of this material body. And with his perfect vision, he witnesses, both externally and internally, all the endeavors of the conditioned soul's heart. This is worth the price of admission. I'm going to read it one more time. The infallible Lord will not consider me an enemy, even though Kamsa has sent me here as his messenger. After all, the omniscient Lord is the actual knower of the field of this material body. And with his perfect vision, he witnesses both externally and internally all the endeavors of the conditioned soul's heart. So, there are many impossible situations in this lifetime. And as we navigate through this life in these various situations, and we should know that there will be many complex situations, we should maintain this internal fortitude of remembering that our decision to surrender to Krishna is duly noted by him. Mm-hmm. And that we should continue to make our individual decisions based on what's best to advance in devotional service. And by doing that, we will make a complete success of this lifetime. And one can only do such, one must make decisions anyway. So basing them on how to advance one's devotional service will be altogether successful. And it's practical because you have to make them one at a time anyway. So this is my the idea that I placed before you today for your consideration. Any reflections or questions? Yes.
I have something that happened today. It's kind of a dilemma in that regards with Parvati sent me an email that said that they couldn't find my reservation for the place I usually rent in Vrindavan. And it kind of increased my fear and increased my desire and determination to go there. So I sent emails to her and the MVT and everybody saying, please look for it or find me something else. I'm willing to go down in quality or up in price. And it's kind of like my fear of not being having a place there, but my desire to go both increased at the same time. So I don't know what to do next. More digging, more emails. Wait to see what happens.
Got a question?
Yes.
Well, I've seen a lot of... whatever somebody says, the place is completely full. It's never true.
Yes.
If you take a risk and go, you can always find something.
It's better than taking the risk of not going.
Yeah, better than taking the risk of not going.
Yes, that's... I'm glad you put it that way because there is some risk, but the risk of not going, I'll find something. They'll either find that or they'll find something else that I put out the feelers to do that. That is the best way, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'll get there on the 28th. It's before Kartik. I'm praying to Radharani more. And so I guess the dilemma almost makes the desire stronger, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Rather than just thinking, well, I'll float in.
When I was in New York once at 340 West 55th, Roman Padmarsh, I think he was still Ramachari at that time, he was our Sankirtan leader, and he told me to go and travel in Sankirtan. I said, great, who am I going with? He said, nobody, just the Maharaj. Are you supposed to go and travel with other devotees? He said, Prabhupada said, you should always remember that Krishna's in your heart, you're never alone. I said, okay. So I jumped in the van, it was the middle of winter, and I started driving, and then I realized halfway down the turnpike that there was no heat in that car, which was pretty typical for a Hinduist vehicle. It was really cold. But I just set out on that journey, and I wasn't sure if I was going to go or stay or anything. And I had the most wonderful experiences.
Wow.
And Krishna made all these arrangements. It reminds me also, I was interviewing Mahatma Prabhu, who... has been in the movement for many years, and he was a temple president in Vancouver, Canada, around 1970. And it was around the time the devotees were going around door to door distributing back the guided magazines, and the Krishna book had just come out. And Prabhupada had asked the devotees to distribute the Krishna book, and nobody could figure out how we're going to do this. They were getting 25 cents for a magazine, and they had to get $8 for the Krishna book. And they thought, you know, who's going to buy a big religious book like this for $8, which is a lot of money, and so forth. But anyway, they just took them out, and they went and tried, and one devotee succeeded, and then they thought, we can do this more. And then they got information, which was coming from Shama Sundar, Prabhupada's personal secretary, who was traveling with Prabhupada, and he would make these notations. No internet, of course, at that time. It would just come out in a newsletter, what Prabhupada was saying. And one of the things he said was, anyone who... without consideration of shelter or their own personal conveniences goes out to teach Krishna consciousness and takes a risk. I take the dust from their feet and I put it on my head. So the devotees got so inspired that they just loaded up a van and they put in some dry dal and some rice and a bunch of books, and they drove off into the into the interior of Canada thinking, we're going to do this. And they ended up in a small town, and there was snow coming down, and they thought, what do we do now? They got out and started chanting on the street. And there was one devotee with them, Thakur Haridas, who had come from San Francisco and knew a little bit about how to sell a Krishna book because he had done it a couple of times. So there was nobody on the street except one man who had come from the bar and he could barely walk. And he was the only person on the street at the time. So Haridas Thakur approached him and showed him the Krishna book, and he bought it for $8. But then they realized that they were in the middle of a snowstorm and they had no place to stay. So they started driving around the town, and then they found a hostel. They went and knocked on the door, and the man was very welcoming, and it was like the perfect ashram for them. And Mahatma had noted that this depending on Krishna is really, really works and is exciting. So they went on with many adventures like that. And also I heard Prabhupada talking about when he was a child, there was a large building. It's almost like a replica of the Taj Mahal that was being built in New Delhi. Or maybe it was Calcutta, yeah. And Prabhupada said he climbed up the scaffolding and he went all the way to the top. And Brahmananda, who was on the walk with Prabhupada, said, Prabhupada, you were very brave. And Prabhupada said, I'm still very brave. Otherwise, how is it I came alone to your country? So I'm just saying.
That's worth much more than the price of admission. Thank you.
Any other reflections or questions? Reflection means one thing that you heard that caught your interest, or you thought maybe this is usable, inspiring. Yeah.
So I think this is a common theme that I hear in a lot of your lectures, and it always gives me hope each time I hear it. It's just that each little step that I take towards my spiritual life is worth it. That I just keep moving forward, and knowing that even if I step back, as long as I keep moving forward, I'm still making progress, and that always gives me hope.
Nice reflection, very powerful. And I mean, the question is, how do I advance? Often times is the question, and the only answer can be to do what you can with what you have right now. And it's true, every tiny step that we make is very significant. I was thinking the other day about how Lord Ramachandra makes a proclamation that anyone who one time says, I surrender to you, he said, from then on, I become that person's protector. What to speak of somebody, you know, who is making the great struggle and endeavor on a daily basis to... It's the small victories that really are powerful. I mean, we can think about big victories, but oftentimes that they become philosophized and I don't actually make them. But the small victory that I'm able to turn off the internet and turn on my japa right now, those we can build on that. One tiny little victory at a time. Someone once told me, yes, please go ahead. Lauren.
I was just going to add to what Kathleen was saying, and I've noticed in my life very recently that the decision to actually let things go as a choice has created more space for Krishna to come into my life and bring forth new things, versus a choice toward him, rejecting that which is unfavorable has also been a choice toward Krishna, and the space that's been opened up is just...
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the choice to give up things that were you thought were really important for the sake, and then it opened up more space. It, yeah. Profound, yeah. I mean, these are fundamental things Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita also. He's encouraging us over and over again that let go of the wheel a little bit and see what happens. That, for instance, in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a way in which Krishna encourages us that there are various levels of devotional service and ways to approach him and to make advancement. And some of them include, you know, he says, just be detached from the results of your activities, just as an example. And in that, you'll start to develop this sentiment or a realization that there's a bigger world out there that I'm not controlling, and that is, you know, that I can enter into and so forth. What to speak if someone makes, like you, make a life choice. You have an obvious choice. I can take this, progressive step to develop my education and so forth, or I can make a progressive step to develop my sadhana and association and everything. And then you take that, and then it opens up much, much more than you thought. Right? Nice. What else? Yes, we're going to do the promo.
But you said, like, from very profound, the whole thing, but one thing that stuck with me is management, not at the expense of Bhagavatam class.
Management? The best thing I learned out of the management and leadership class is the disgust of Jayadvaita Swami with all his experience. And, you know, it all came out. If that's also just, this is sort of an aside, but getting, you know, being in front of somebody who has had experience, I hate to use this word, but I'm going to anyway, it's like a download of information. I had it, you know, and I got that from Jayadvaita Swami. All the experience he had had, the heartbreak he had seen from people who, you know, sacrificed their sadhana and then, you know, broke other people's hearts by going away because they had, you know, not balanced their life and so forth. It all came out in that one gesture. And that one statement that he made and so forth, the kind of, yeah, I won't say any more than that because maybe there's a few more reflections. What else? Yeah.
I like telling the story how he was saying, I'm going on this trip, I'm going to see Krishna. I don't really think I'm worthy, but I'm going to put that aside and just still go on the trip because that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And by his grace, I'll get there.
Yeah, yeah. It's a long journey we're going on, and also I brought in that verse from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the far shore. I mean, it's so far away; it's unimaginable. How could I? Who, me? I can't do this. But over and over again in the Shastra, and you know, we've been giving this encouragement. You know, you can do this. Keep going. One of my favorite statements. It's a little corny, but I like it. Big shot's just a little shot who kept on shooting, or who keeps on shooting. I remember that because it's like the little shots that you take. And I see this all the time. You know, people who are just steady, they just steadily do the right thing. They rise. I heard Jayadvaita Maharaj once say, cream rises to the top. He made it as an encouragement to somebody, you know, who was doing well. And he said, yeah, cream rises to the top. Why wouldn't it? And if you make your heart, that if and you have that decision, you have that determination in your heart that I'm going to surrender to Krishna, and you do what you can where you are, it will be discovered. Krishna knows it. He'll make all the arrangements. I was in New York City a couple of years ago. Actually, it was more than a couple. I think it was 7 years ago. I mean, I was there recently, but I'm remembering back to a time I had lived in New York City for 3 years, but I didn't know the city because I was engaged in a service that I kept totally focused for 3 years. And I didn't take any time to look around New York. So, Kashtuba Prabhu, who's an old friend of mine, invited me to see the city of New York. He said, I'll show you around. So we were walking through a neighborhood that had a lot of skyscraper buildings. He said, look at all those. I said, I am looking at them all. And he said, where do you think they came from? I said, well, somebody built them. And he said, yeah, but there weren't any. And then all of a sudden there were skyscraper buildings. How do you think it was possible? And I said, well, I have no idea. But it's probably something technological. And he said, yes. What is it? And I said, I don't know. And he said, steel cable. Steel cable, he said. Someone who was working with steel and experimenting developed steel cable, and that previously they were not able to pull an elevator car up more than a couple of floors because they didn't have a strong enough implement to do that until the flexible steel cable came in, and then they could go many floors. And then what happened was all the high-rise buildings came up. All the skyscrapers were possible, not just in New York, but all over the world. So I was meditating on that, how somebody, they dedicated their life to this one little project. And then when it came out, it changed the whole world. So I translated into that, as far as our devotional service and our own life and success and our contribution to the world goes, that if we work on our gifts and we work on what we have now that's available to us, even if it seems small and insignificant, it will become significant. It will become a part that will influence others all over the world. And I've seen it over and over again. Somebody in a dusty little room somewhere who's dedicated, who's made a decision in their heart to take the devotional service, and they go on with their service. They may not be popular, known, anything, but after some time, Krishna makes them famous. Not that they're even interested in fame, but Krishna wants people to see, here's somebody doing something. And then suddenly there's a city built around the little dusty room, and everyone's coming to see that person and take strength from that person. So it's the fact that Krishna's within our heart, just as Akur is remembering, doesn't matter what my circumstance is now, if I'm sincerely moving in that direction, then Krishna will arrange and adjust everything. We have time for two more. Yes.
Good to see you, Prabhu.
Good to see you too.
Your presence alone lifts us up and lights us up.
Kuchita koso, as they say in Japan. Same to you.
You know, I guess I'm amongst probably more advanced souls than myself, but I'm always trying to strike that balance between spiritual life and my earthly goals or dreams that I have. You know, on one hand, I want to move closer to God and into Krishna consciousness. On the other hand, I have these career goals, relationships, things like that that I want to maintain and satisfy here. And so I did appreciate what you had to say about the universe opening up, conspire to help us achieve our decisions or to bring about the effect of our decisions. But I guess my question goes more to how we achieve that balance. And I think you said, maybe it's best to put your spiritual life first and then plan everything else around it.
Well, a couple comments about that. We may not be able to put our spiritual life first because we're so consumed with what we're already doing. We may put it first in our heart, as I was saying, and that's our intention. But it mostly comes in as a wedge. A wedge has a very small end and then a big end. And it starts off as something small. Another example, making dahi, yogurt. Ahimsa. You start with a big pot of milk, and you put in a little bit of yogurt culture. You put it the whole pot in the right environment, and then, what happens? The whole pot transforms. So, spiritual life, we may not have the capability of wholesale changing over to a spiritual life. Not something that one can do simply by willing to do it all of a sudden. But if you add Krishna consciousness to what you're already doing, and you continue to add it in increments as much as you're capable of doing, because we all have a capacity to do that. And as we get more mercy, we get more capacity to add more. It's mercy. That will begin to transform everything in our lives in a natural way. And the Sri Yashopanishad says, vidyam cha yas, tad vedo vayam saha, avidyayam ritum kirtva, vidyayam ritum ashnite. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. I'll give a testimonial about how that worked in my life as the last thing I say tonight. Should I? Dare I give a personal testimonial? All right. Here goes. I had a business for 10 years. And I put a lot of energy into it. At the same time, I continued my devotional service. And I had a lot of optimism for my business because I had a lot of faith in myself. Because, I don't know, I had a good life. I grew up with good parents. Everything seemed to go well for me. And I also just had a lot of confidence that I could do really well in business. So I put a lot of energy into it because of that optimism. And like everything else in the world, there's complications and complexities and so forth. As I was doing the business, along with my devotional service, I developed a feeling about what was more important to me in my life. And one day, and the culmination of that feeling was, I was on the phone talking to a potential customer. And I was describing the merits of the product that I was offering. And he was arguing with me. And then I argued a little bit more detail to educate and enlighten him, and he argued a little bit more back. And all of a sudden, I had this visceral experience throughout my body and mind. I had this epiphany that I don't want to use any more of my energy to sell anything that's not Krishna. I'm using my breath, I'm using my energy, I'm using my mental strength to try to sell this person on a product, but it's not Krishna. And when I hung up the phone, I felt this great sense of relief. Not that I simply dropped the business and ran, but I made a pact that whatever business was still there was coming to me. I would take it, I would allow it to come in, and I would take care of the other people that I had set up in business and so forth, and not neglect my duty. But I was detaching myself because it was real. It was something that actually came to me personally. And then I just let go of it. Now, the funniest thing was, the business kept going, and a couple years later, I got a call saying, well, you had a banner year. How did you do so well? And I said, I have no idea. I didn't do anything. And this kind of what you're saying about letting go of things and opening up, and also there's a way in which if you go on with your life, but you continue with your practice of Krishna consciousness in a methodical, steady way, Krishna will transform the things that you're doing in your life in a way that will give you more realization about your aspiration in this world. It'll be real. It'll become a mature realization. And that's necessary to move forward with this decision. Maturity means that you've made this decision based on your own free will. And you've seen both sides clearly. And you have choices, but you still decide, I'm going to do this. That's powerful. That's where the energy comes from. Om Tat Sat. Thank you very much. Very much. And I didn't get a chance to tell you about it because you surrendered to it. It's so wonderful to see you all and to be here in this jewel of a temple, which is radiating. Everyone who comes in the orbit of this place becomes inspired in Krishna consciousness. It's really become a center for reviving Krishna consciousness all over the world, what you're doing in this one place, and also Long Beach and so forth. So thank you very much. Just coming down here, we feel ecstatic. Hare Krishna.
Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman. Hey! Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman.